Voices and Events. The National Broadcasting Company brings you Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, recorded by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You'll hear Marshal Tito, Anatol Barzov, Ernest Bevin, Walter Reuther, General Harry Vaughn, these and many others, the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now here's your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
This week, because one man in Eastern Europe stood alone against the common form, the Balkans were seething with rumors of war.
I radni kolektiv koji je stvoren u procesu revolucionarne borbe sa revolucionarnim parolama, a ne samo na parolama borbe protiv okupatora.
You are listening, perhaps for the first time, to the voice of Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia, hero of his country's resistance and friend of Stalin until 15 months ago when the common form turned against him. Today, Pravda calls Tito a traitor. Rumors were a ruble a dozen in the Balkans this week, but Belgrade was calm and quiet in spite of a torrent of abuse that came from Radio Moscow.
The working people of our country are full of indignation evoked by the latest foul action of the fascist beast in Belgrade. The working people of the Romanian People's Republic are confident that the people of Yugoslavia will find the right way to overthrow the fascist leadership and find a way of returning to the great and invincible camp of democracy and socialism headed by the mighty Soviet Union. And that's the end of the news broadcast to you from Radio Moscow.
Yes, that's an actual broadcast heard by NBC monitors this week as the pace quickened in the nerve war in Russia's front yard. Marshal Tito is not so inaccessible as other leaders of Eastern Europe. This week, an American university professor and five other Americans visited Tito at his summer home, talked over the tense and complex situation. Last night, Dr. Kirtley Mather, professor of geology at Harvard University, returned from this visit to Boston and gave his account of the meeting with Tito. Listen now to the report of a man who spoke with Marshal Tito this week.
He was dressed just like an ordinary American businessman, in a double-breasted Palm Beach suit with a bright necktie. He didn't even wear a military decoration of any sort. Most significant to me was his definite assertion that although he greatly desires more cordial relations between his country and ours, he is not willing to permit any foreign government to interfere in any way with his own program for the internal reconstruction and development of Yugoslavia. Regardless of the conflict between Tito and the common form, Tito is a communist and will remain so until he dies. Well, he does not believe that the present war of words will lead to a war of bullets. What Marshal Tito fears is economic strangulation rather than military invasion.
Their names are Peter Pirogov and Anatol Barzov, and they had fled their homeland for our America.
The story of Pirogov and Barzov was as dramatic this week as it was that day last winter when the two Russian airmen deserted the Soviet Union and were given haven in the USA. This week, Anatol Barzov changed his mind. After 7 months in the United States, he wanted to go home, and the State Department readily obliged. At a lonely outpost in Austria, American authorities said goodbye to Barzov. He crossed the line, entered a Red Army car, and disappeared into the silence of the East. Back home here, Peter Pirogov denounced his erstwhile companion and said, "Soviet Russia will not have forgotten Barzov's words on deserting to America. Remember that day last February at the Washington airport when Barzov and an interpreter faced a microphone?"
Плохое житие народа. Быть и русского, вообще всех народов в России.
Well, to put it very, very few words, he felt that in Russia he couldn't do as he wanted. He couldn't live as he wanted.
Were you very unhappy in Russia?
Yeah, no happy.
You weren't happy, huh?
No happy.
And why? Maybe I know.
And now back in Russia, these are the words that Barzov would like to forget.
People in the news, and the dramatic story of how hundreds of rescuers struggled to save the life of a schoolboy.
It happened in Elkhart, Indiana, where 17-year-old Gene Saunders was working as a farmhand on his summer vacation. Just as he finished digging a 20-foot well, he slipped and fell into the gaping pit. Within minutes, a sandslide had trapped him, and only his head was above the surface. Hundreds of police and firemen and friends worked for 6 hours to release him. At times, he called up to the surface. It was no use. Microphones of station WTRC were on the scene and recorded the labored breathing of the boy in the well and his conversation with rescuers on the surface.
Hey, fella?
Yeah?
How you doing down there?
Dying.
How's your breathing down there?
I'm living, if that's what you mean.
Getting plenty of air?
I ain't getting enough.
Okay, how do you feel? Pretty lousy?
Yeah. Cold.
Cold?
My legs are can't feel a thing no more.
Uh-huh.
You'll get me out pretty soon, you cut them off.
Are your feet in water?
No.
What position are you in down there?
Sit down position.
Sitting down?
Yeah.
Okay, fella.
One unhappy boy was Gene Sanders. But 6 hours later, he was brought safely to the surface. Doctor said, aside from a few small bruises, he was perfectly okay.
For many, the 1st of September is a date of very great significance.
Yes, oysters are again in season. The first R month since April is a notable occasion. The hot summer meant a bountiful crop of oysters this year, the best in a decade, some say. What are an oyster man's problems? Well, surprisingly, it's the poacher, the oyster rustler. We heard about it from veteran oyster man W. Ellsworth Sprague, who told us how these illegal oyster hoisters operate.
Well, they go out at night, and they have a dredge on their boat, and they just go. They don't care whose grounds they go on.
Do you recollect any particular oyster pirate?
Well, I wouldn't mention any names about them, but there's been a few cases that I do know of. I know years ago my father hired a watchman one time and bought him a rifle with orders to shoot through the bottom of the boat at the waterline. So my father went out on his own grounds fishing a few days later, and he was shot at, too.
how do they normally get rid of these pirates?
Well, of course, they try to arrest them if they can and prove it, which is a pretty hard thing to identify an oyster after the oyster's out of water. But I know one way in Greenport a few years ago. They hired him as a watchman.
They hired the pirate as a watchman?
Yeah. They thought that was the best. They knew where he was then all the time.
Well, talk about oysters, and someone's bound to ask, what are my chances of finding a pearl? NBC roving reporter W.W. Chaplin checked up as he took his microphone to the town which calls itself the Oyster Capital, the town of Bivalve, New Jersey.
Shucking, a branch of the industry which employs over 1,000 men hereabouts, is just over for the day. But an oyster boat, the Ellie Yates, is just in. You can hear, I'm sure, the dredger's winder and the conveyor, which carries the catch to the shucking rooms. The shuckers might seem to be the lucky folk in this business because they do get the first peek at where the pearls come from. But the head man tells me that the occasional pearls in these eating oysters are irregular and just about worthless. This is W.W. Chaplin at Bivalve, New Jersey.
Labor Day, 1949, the last holiday of the summer.
Across most of the nation, it's clear and cool. The crisp fall air, perhaps a bit ahead of schedule. The season's changing. You can see it in the country and in the shop windows along Fifth Avenue. Youngsters are thinking about school, and soon football will be crowding World Series talk in the sports pages. But Labor Day this year is something else. It's a time when working men of democratic nations all over the world salute each other on a job well done.
I would like to say to the American workers that we workers in France take a great interest in the American labor movement. We know that it is strong now. We want it to be stronger in the future.
Shipbuilders of San Francisco, builders of Elko, Nevada, copper miners of Salt Lake City, automobile workers of Detroit, musicians of New York, textile workers of Philadelphia, American labor, wherever you are, the Dutch workers hail you.
On behalf of the Norwegian trade union movement, I want to extend greetings to workers everywhere on this occasion of America's Labor Day. It is only natural for me on this day to salute also the Marshall Plan and the efforts of American workers to help the workers and the people of Western Europe toward recovery.
Those are the voices of labor leaders in France, Holland, and Norway, sending greetings on the day set aside by our nation to honor its working people. Listen to the voice of Italy, where labor representatives of the Marshall Plan administration took their microphones into the field.
Well, September the 5th is Labor Day in the United States, yes. The day devoted to the American worker.
Yes.
Do you have anything you would like to say to your American brothers on that occasion?
Yes, we can only say grazie for discipline that gives our country a chance.
What is your name?
Antonio Marinillo. I'm bossy.
Now, I know because you're boss here that you must be aware that this is an ERP project. What do you think of the Marshall Plan?
I think it is good because it gives us plenty job.
Now, you heard me tell Lewis about Labor Day. Do you have any message for the American worker?
Like Lewis, we can say tante grazie.
England, too, where the trade unionists have been elected to government, has thoughtful words for America's Labor Day. Hear it from Vincent Toussaint, General Secretary of the British Trade Union Congress.
So today is Labor Day. Well, to all of you, I send my warmest greetings and also those of the organized workers of Great Britain. Have a good time, but try to give a thought to some of the things which this day symbolizes. Well, we're thinking of you on your day. Enjoy it as you can, but in a quiet and determined way, let us all rededicate ourselves to the fundamental and vital tasks to which organized labor in our two countries has set its hand.
We also called on American labor. From the ranks of hundreds of labor leaders and statesmen, Voices and Events asked Walter Reuther, the militant young leader of the CIO auto workers, what are his thoughts for Labor Day 1949.
This Labor Day finds America and the world in a period of twilight and uncertainty. We have neither prosperity nor depression in America. We have neither peace nor war in the world. This is a dangerous period. We can drift to depression at home and war in the world unless we avert disaster by working and planning for prosperity and peace. On this Labor Day, American labor reaffirms its faith in basic human values. It reasserts the sovereignty of people over profits, of human rights over property rights. We declare that the American economy must become freedom's greatest asset in peace as it was in war.
After weeks of waiting, the nation was rewarded this week with a public appearance by Major General Harry Vaughan.
President Truman's military aide, topic of no little congressional conversation, made a belated appearance in the 5%er investigation, the inquiry in which his name has been mentioned so often. It went like this when Chairman Hoey of the Senate Investigating Committee started the day's proceedings.
Now, General Vaughan, if you'll give your name, position, and residence to the reporter.
Harry H. Vaughan, Major General, United States Army Reserve. Military aid to the president.
And among the many things the senators wanted to know, just how big a man was this Maragon? Was he Vaughan's friend around the White House? For instance, was it true that he used General Vaughan's White House office as if he owned the place?
I happened to come into the office and he was sitting there. Just as I came in, the phone rang. And the secretary handed the phone to him. In a few minutes, I called her in and I said, "What goes on here?" Well, she said, John made the call, and the man was busy, and he asked him to call him back. Well, I said, that, of course, can't continue because people cannot use my office for returning calls. So I instructed that that would be discontinued as of that date, and I instructed John, and, of course, he said, he had a very plausible explanation for the few times he had done it, but it discontinued then.
Did John ever visit your office after that, or was that reprimand sufficient to keep him away?
No, he don't reprimand easy,
Senator. Wouldn't it be an easy matter for you just to keep him out of the White House? Can't you just tell the guard out there to keep him out?
Oh, yes, I could do that, but Maragon's a lovable sort of a chap. You can't get mad at him. It's hard to do, at least.
You still feel that way in view of his refusal to testify on the ground that would incriminate him?
No, he's got to be pretty well
washed up before, fumigated before. I mean,
it gets beyond the point where he gets lovable when he conducts himself that way, don't you think?
Well, I'm frank to admit that I think... And I think most of Maragon's sins have not been with malice, but have been with just... I don't think he half the time is sure about what he's doing himself.
Don't you think that it's possible from now on maybe to keep him out of the White House?
I think it's not only possible, but probable.
Well, that out of the way, the senators turned to Harry Vaughan's ability to get scarce autos for friends back in the days when they were so very scarce and often sold well above the list price. There was quite an exchange here. Listen as Committee Chairman Huey bangs his gavel and reprimands his colleagues when they question General Vaughan.
Well, I say I can't recall the exact date that I bought this package.
Well, all right. Now, any other car? Say a Buick.
No, I've never owned a Buick, Mark.
How about an Oldsmobile?
Never owned an Oldsmobile in my life.
Didn't you secure an Oldsmobile in 47?
I did not. I've never owned an Oldsmobile.
Do you know a Mrs. Morris Cavanaugh of Spring Green, Wisconsin?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. I bought that
for her. Oh, yes.
Well, that's not me. I've helped several people get cars.
All right. Now, you helped her get a car in 47. And who paid for the car?
Her fiancé, who was here to get it.
I see. And do you know what happened to that car?
Well, he got in it and left town in it. Now, I don't know what happened to it from there.
Do you know that car, yesterday, I'll tell you this, just so you can refresh your recollection, see if you can give us any further facts. Yesterday, our staff got in touch with her to find out what happened to this car. We found that it was black marketed. She admitted that she made $600 or $700 on it. It showed up 3 or 4 days later on a used car lot over in Iowa. Now, will you tell us why you got her this car?
Yes, she and her fiancé were friends of mine, and he was in town, and he asked me if I could introduce him somewhere he could buy a car. I took him up to this... I don't remember. The Oldsmobile dealer here. I don't remember where it was.
Did you give the Oldsmobile dealer a check for the car?
No, I think he did.
Right. Do you know the car was registered in your name?
No, I didn't know that.
I was in the market for a car myself, but that time, General Vaughan, I think I overlooked a bet. I didn't know that part of your function down there was to procure scarce automobiles for indigenous citizens. Was that generally a practice of yours?
Well, these people were friends of mine, and they needed automobiles, and I sent them to where I thought they could get one.
How'd you work it? I was unable to do it. Tell me how you did it. What did you say to these guys?
I didn't know that there was any particular...
I think it's gone far enough. I think every senator probably had the same sort of application. I know I had a number of applications made to me, and I called up an automobile dealer here for some of my friends to see if they could possibly... One of them got it, 3 or 4 more didn't get it. I think we're getting into chicken and stuff
never
now.
Never had any success.
just a minute. I don't think we ought to make statements like that. There's no evidence before this committee that General Vaughan procured it for anybody with any sort of knowledge that they're going to use in the black market.
Well, anyway, at week's end, President Truman still stoutly defended his crony and military aide, and Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy, a committee member, was moved to indignant words like this.
The country has been told, in effect, that all the manipulating and dealing on the part of Mr. Vaughan is proper and correct. The president said he was going to keep this man on as his military aide. Apparently keeping him on as coordinator of Veterans Affairs, that is in effect saying to the nation, and I think it's important that the committee take some activity in this, that is in effect saying to all other government employees, what Mr. Vaughan has done is perfectly proper. Go thou and do likewise.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
Germany faces the future. Next Wednesday marks the opening of the newly elected West German Parliament at Bonn, an occasion sure to be watched by a world which has twice in our time suffered from the aggression of a totalitarian German state. In that ancient university city this morning, NBC correspondent Ed Hocker got the story.
Today I'm standing on the bank of the Rhine at Bonn. It's a warm day and the river barges are all displaying laundry. The big white modern parliamentary building looming up here behind me. The building where on Wednesday the first post-war German government will be formally established. I've been wandering around this building today. Here are the voices of some of the workers I've been talking to. Do you speak English?
No, nicht sehr gut, aber hier ist einer, der kann viel besser vielleicht nehmen.
Thank you anyway. Here's a young woman whose job is in what might be called the quartermaster department. Tell me, do you think the government that's going to be established on Wednesday, do you think it'll be a success? The people at home are awfully interested in that, as you might guess.
Oh, the way we have been working for it during the past months down here in Bonn, it certainly should be a success. It must be.
What's the attitude of the Western powers toward the new German parliament? For NBC, the United States High Commissioner for Germany, John J. McCloy, made this statement in Frankfurt on the new German parliament.
Ever since military government took over the responsibility of dealing with Germany after the surrender and collapse of the Nazi regime, the Western powers have looked forward to the time when we could return the task of governing the German people to responsible Germans, duly elected and appointed to their offices by democratic processes. That time has now come, and again the German people are starting off on a new venture in democratic government. We are now to have a new test, and the whole world is watching and hoping that at long last there will be erected in Germany a lasting, peaceful, and democratic state.
What's ahead for Britain? At this hour, somewhere in mid-Atlantic, are the two men who hold the key to England's immediate future.
Bound for America and conferences on Britain's deteriorating economic situation are Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin and Financial Chief Sir Stafford Cripps. From the talks which begin in Washington next week, it is hoped a solution will be found for Britain's economic crisis. We've heard a lot lately about bad feeling in Britain because of severe criticism in the American press of Britain's socialist program. Well, one man did what he could this week to clear the air. President Harry Truman.
The people of this country are well aware of what the war meant to Great Britain and of the stresses and strains which have been laid upon the British people in recent years. The representatives of the United Kingdom will find here a warm personal welcome and may be assured that these mutual problems will be examined by us in a spirit of friendliness and helpfulness.
This was an encouraging statement for British officials, and Ernest Bevin was prompt to say so as he boarded his ship for America.
I'm leaving now with my colleague, Sir Stafford, to try and deal with one of the greatest problems that has faced us since the war, the solution of which, if we achieve it, will make the biggest contribution to peace, security, and prosperity. We are going in the spirit of understanding as expressed by President Truman the other day in Philadelphia.
There were all sorts of conventions over the USA, but none so strange as the gathering in Rochester, New York, this weekend.
Perhaps it's a sign of the times, but some delegates arrived by airplane in Rochester for the convention of the Knights of the Road, the Hobos and Tramps. And still enthroned as King of the Hobos was Jeff Davis. At station WHAM Rochester, they asked Jeff Davis, why on earth a convention of hobos?
Well, the convention here is to do a lot of good things for folks that's on the road, because a hobo will work and he travels, a tramp he travels and don't work, and a bum don't do either one, and on account of them, we were forced to organize, eh?
Uh-huh. What do you do at a hobo convention? I suppose there'll be a giant pot of tramp stew for all to eat?
A wonderful stew. Be a royal gump. Chicken? Oh, about $15 worth of chickens and about, bushels and bushels and bushels of potatoes and turnips and rutabaga and everything else. 50 pounds of beef, too. I hope I don't get any.
In Philadelphia this week, 1.5 million persons watched a parade that took 12 hours to wind its way down Broad Street.
The American Legion Convention, and what a pageant. Philadelphia, a city gone crazy. NBC microphones along the line of march with George Skinner of television station WPTZ reporting the proceedings.
A lot of folks dropped in on this American Legion Convention in Philadelphia, but when Marie McMillan says she dropped in, she isn't kidding, are you, Marie?
That's right.
And the reason is Marie arrived by parachute, of all ways to get here. When did you land?
This afternoon at 12:30.
Isn't it a thrill to jump out of an airplane, even when there isn't a convention?
There's nothing like it. Nothing like a good jump.
Is this something new to you, or?
Oh, yes. It's been for the last 20 years, I believe.
The Allegheny County
198 parachute jumps.
The 1911 Renault. It used to be a taxi cab used by General Foch over on the other side of the Battle of Marne. We brought it over in 1920.
Oh, it's a real relic of World War I, huh?
That's right.
And who are the drivers here?
Why, this is Mr. Sutton from Bristol.
I do. And you were the head of our...
And my name is Price from 207 Post of Scranton, PA.
Oh, this... Thank you for the horn. Sounds like Clarabel on Naughty Duty. Okay. Well, that's a wonderful relic of the World War I, and it really adds a lot to our Legion parade here in Philadelphia. Of all the people who have been watching the parade here in Philadelphia, I know there's one who has a big lump in his throat. And he's the retiring national commander of the American Legion, Perry Brown. How does it feel to be retiring?
Well, to be perfectly frank, it feels good, you know. I have a chance to rest a while now.
At the end of the convention to replace the retiring Perry Brown, the American Legion elected as its new national commander, George Craig of Indiana. Commander Craig was asked, what are the interests of the American Legion?
Well, the Legion is interested primarily in calling to the attention of the American people the principles and objects of the Legion, which are national security, rehabilitation of our veterans, which are a part of the cost of war, child welfare, and foreign affairs and relationships.
Veterans of another war were also holding an encampment this week, their last.
Sadly, but proudly, the last veterans of the Union Army announced their meeting this week in Indianapolis was the last reunion of the GAR. Only 8 of them are left. Only 6 could make the trip to Indianapolis. There was a torchlight parade for them, a last chorus of "Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory." And then, an evening of swapping stories among these old-timers. Station WIRE asked Albert Wilson of Minnesota, "How old are you?"
102 and 4.5 years.
Yeah.
End of August. I was born near the city of Watertown, New York. When I was a boy about 13 years of age, my uncle took me, I think it was to Albany. There was a debate between two men that night. My uncle says to me, "Do you see that man with the stovepipe hat on?" He said, "That's Abe Lincoln." The other man is Stephen Douglas. I voted for Abraham Lincoln while in the service, though not of age. I was about 18 at that time. That was the fall election of 64. I voted for him ever since. The Republican ticket.
Yes, a real son of the Grand Army of the Republic. Albert Wilson of Minnesota, 102 years old plus, and a member of the Republican Party since 1864.
This has been Voices and Events, the living record of history this week, compiled by the News and Special Events Department of the National Broadcasting Company. The actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor has been James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking, and inviting you to listen at this same time next week for Voices and Events. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.